From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In 2012, Jeremy Howard Beck and Stephanie Fleischman had scored a commission to write an opera, but they couldn't come up with the right story. They went through idea after idea, and finally, in a moment of desperation, Jeremy went into a bookstore and started looking at titles. And there, on the new releases table, he saw Brian Kastner's powerful memoir as the leader of a military bomb disposal team in Iraq. The book is called The Long Walk, and it's about Kastner's war experience, about being shot at, being brain damaged by the explosive waves of bombs, but also his struggle to make the transition from war to civilian life. Beck and Fleischman had their idea. Their opera is being performed in Salt Lake City this weekend, so we're talking about The Long Walk today, after the news.
Hey there, podcast listener. I'm Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. If you enjoy the show, we'd appreciate it if you did us a little favor. Find us on the iTunes store and leave us a review. Let us know what you think. It's valuable feedback for us, and frankly, the more reviews we have, the more listeners we can attract. Thanks in advance. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Maybe you've heard of the term the long walk. It's what the people in bomb disposal teams in the military call that experience of leaving the safety of your vehicle and taking that walk to defuse an explosive device. Brian Kastner is a former Air Force officer who commanded one of these teams. They're called EODs, Explosive Ordnance Disposal Units. A few years ago, he wrote a remarkably honest memoir about his experience in Iraq, the brutality and intensity of disarming a bomb. The explosive waves from hundreds of these blasts damaged his brain. He forgot whole sections of his life before with his wife, Jessie, and his kids. So the book is a war story, but it's also about the challenge of returning home, as the subtitle puts it, the life that follows. The book is also an opera now, and it's being performed in Salt Lake City this weekend. So we're talking about the book and the opera today, and we begin with Brian Kastner. So, Brian, I wanted to begin with, as you say in the book, you were assigned to be a civil engineer at first. Super boring. As you say, you know, pouring runways and fixing buildings. And then, of course, 9/11 happens, and you write about in the book going to this meeting. U.S. intelligence, these guys in beards are talking to the group gathered, and they say U.S. intelligence has learned that Osama bin Laden had acquired two of the missing Soviet suitcase nukes, and right. that we think he intends to use them. And the reason you're here is we want to teach you how to turn this off if in case you find it, right?
That's right.
So now I want to ask you about this part in the story, because you say in the book that as they're doing this, explaining how to dismantle this thing, that you sat in silent rapture, that you memorized every word. Like, it seemed like a really important moment in some ways for you.
Yeah, I think I could still tell you that you turn the dial like three knobs this way, and then there's like another little knob, and I can see the thing, and it's green, and it's, you know, the size of a trash can. And yeah, it was really fundamental for me, or really influential, because I had met these EOD guys, Explosive Ordnance Disposal, the bomb squad. I had met some of these guys, but I had never seen them in a professional environment. And what I mean by that is in a case where they might be doing their job. And this thing that was so amazing to me, oh my, you're teaching me to do what?
Yeah.
And what is this thing? And Soviet backpack, whatever. And for these guys, it was like Tuesday. Like they, right. they had done this before. They had worked on it before. There was just such a casual confidence with it. And I'm like, that's what I want. I want to feel like these guys do, looking at this thing, instead of being bug-eyed and a little freaked out.
So part of it that was appealing wasn't just that, oh, this is exciting, this is explosive ordnance or whatever. It was that these guys knew their stuff.
Oh, absolutely. The most professional, confident, maybe a little egotistical, but just because they're just so good at their job, And I knew the school was really hard, and I knew it was this exclusive fraternity, although men and women both do the job. But yeah, I wanted in. I wanted to be part of that. I wanted to have that much confidence in myself that they obviously did in themselves.
I want to ask you about one of the elements of the book that I found really interesting is the way you describe in really candid, graphic ways the body parts in the aftermath of bombings. And I wanted to ask you about writing some of these sections. Early in the book, there's this moment where you're in the aftermath of a particular bombing and you catch the powerful smell of human waste.
Right.
And then you find, and I'm going to read how you put it here. You said, "There at my feet was a perfectly formed and entirely intact lower intestine." And you described it as beautiful.
I think the beautiful is like surprising, or you know, like you know, it's you know, the human body can be beautiful. It's this natural thing in a completely unnatural way. It's lying on the asphalt and it's cooking.
It's super hot.
Super hot. Yeah. And that's why I could smell it.
Yeah.
Is because it was 125 degrees. And it's like a skillet, right? So it's beautiful in the in like a startling, like, you know, surprising kind of way. There's all this stuff that happens in a war that I feel like could only happen in a war.
Yeah.
All these like little and it's not just the killing or the, you know, what people tend to think about in the war. It's all these little moments. In an intestine, a colon on the street, smoking a cigar while there's artillery fire, you know, going out, having a pigeon land on your Humvee
during a dust storm
while you're driving in a dust storm, yeah. And you're still driving and it lands and just hangs out with you. And so I tried in the book as much as, yeah, there's lots of graphic stuff in there, but I also tried to capture these little moments that I feel like could only have happened in that situation.
The thing that's interesting to me about that too is, and this is, let me just mention another graphic image. I don't want to overplay this, but I just think that it's interesting. One of the images that comes up from time to time in the book and in the opera is this foot in a box.
Right.
And it's a story you tell in northern Kirkuk in this market. You've gone to explore the aftermath of this IED explosion. You think 15, 20 dead or something like that. And I want you to just talk about this moment because you talk about the eerie quiet of it. And there, all of a sudden, you find in a cardboard box this foot.
Right.
Now, talk about your reaction to it because it's a moment of almost complete, it's surreal. It's almost completely absurd.
It is. So there was a bombing in a chai shop. In a tenement building. So in one neighborhood in northern Kirkuk, where a lot of Kurds lived, there were a number of high-rise apartment buildings, and they're all poured concrete. And this particular shop in a marketplace was like underground. So there's a certain amount of, you know, Dante and descending down into the underworld to like learn something, you know, about mortality and yourself. And I walk in there, and because the blast was contained, there was like a glass barrier between the chai shop and like this walkway. And of course, the glass is all gone and the walls are completely smeared red. And everything within that area is completely destroyed because the blast was contained. So utter devastation, tiny little pieces. But there's a folding table set up and a box and a foot sitting in the box. And the foot has a sandal. And like the one end of it is like splayed open. And it took me a while to figure out what it was. And I laughed.
Yeah.
I tried like looking around for the other guys on my team, like, come look at the joke. There's a foot in the box. And it just, I think it's the absurdity. I mean, it's the darkest of dark humor, right. But it also makes sense to me, like, oh, here's a piece bigger than the rest. We should save that. Oh, put it in a box over there. And so there's a logic to the absurdity, but I don't know. I still struggle to say exactly what was so funny about it, except the incongruity of the whole thing.
The very first thing you do in the book is reveal that you're crazy.
Right.
And you say there's this list. It used to be a really small list of people that you kind of come out to that saying you're crazy. It's pretty small. Certain friends, but not others. Your wife, not your mom. Those you say in the book who are going to get it.
Right.
But then the first thing you do in the book is you tell all of us.
Well, you're not supposed to bury the lead, right? You're supposed to put it up front. And I think it was the most important part. Like, the rest of this book's not going to make sense unless you know that I'm crazy. And so it's not exactly like coming out, but it was I think what I was getting at, and like right at the very beginning, is why write a book? Yeah. Because lots of veterans can find lots of catharsis and therapy in writing for themselves, writing their own story, trying to figure out what happened to them. I need to say what happened to my buddies. And you can put it in a journal and put it in a drawer and probably get 99% of the therapy that I did. Yeah. But I chose to write a book. And so I wanted to be honest with the reader up front and say, yes, I am telling you something that I normally don't tell other people, and I'm telling everybody, and I've made this choice. And I think that's part of that is that I wanted to be a writer, and I thought I had a story that maybe other people would be interested in. And so I was always conscious of not just writing. That little piece is where I reveal that I'm not just writing for myself, but I'm writing for you, the
exactly.
reader,
yeah.
as well. And you're allowed to be a part of this story.
You say you're crazy is a feeling. It's the worst, most intolerable feeling you've ever had. Never goes away. And I wanted to ask you about this. You describe it as that last week of school before summer vacation. And you've got one more exam. And that's the thing that stands between you and going outside.
Right. Maybe that's just a very Buffalo, New York feeling because we have the winter, like the gray,
right.
dark winter all year. And in New York, school ends in June. And so you've got the lawnmowers and the baseball games and the whole bit. And it's too warm and you're like I think I describe, you're like sweating in your seat and you just want to get out. And I'm not the only one, I suppose, that was desperate for the end of school. But of course, the difference is that like when you're done with school, you feel better. And I never felt any better. The good news is I should say I do now.
Yeah.
But I didn't at the time, and it never went away, and it didn't go away for months and months and months. And I just was planning on living my life in the middle of this, and that was just intolerable, right?
When did the crazy first emerge? And do you think it was it the result of, I mean, one of the things that you write about in the book is that the effect of these bomb blasts on the physical effect on your body.
Right.
These explosive waves. Right? That's one thing you talk about. But then there's an emotional component.
Right.
So which part of that causes the crazy to come out?
Both.
Really?
Or the combination. Like I still, if I could write this book over, I might not use the word crazy again. Just because it's a bit of a pejorative among veterans, right? Like nobody wants to be that crazy yeah. veteran. And I suppose there's a certain amount of owning the word, but I don't know. I don't know if I would use the word again. And yet at the same time, I don't have a better word.
Yeah.
Still. Because like you say, there is this emotional component of anxiety and fear and grief and loss and depression and a sense of your own mortality and panic. And actually, I do not use the word anxiety a single time in this book. And it's because I didn't want to give the reader a shortcut like, oh, I know what that is, because I know what that is, too. And that's not what this was. But it also was, it was all of those things, but standing in the way of me dealing with that, and plenty of other veterans too, is that when your brain has been through all of these bomb blasts, it just gets tired and you lose memories and it just doesn't work like it should. And so your body needs time to heal, but then you're also trying to emotionally heal, and the two are working at odds with each other.
You say in the book that basically it's you have a broken brain exhausted from fixing itself.
Right. The good news is it does fix itself for lots and lots of people. I wish somebody had said it gets better, but nobody ever said it gets better. There's everything just feels so acute. It's like, how do I live through the next minute? And so maybe if somebody had said, well, 5 years from now, you will feel better, you know, like that would not, that was just a completely incomprehensible thing. But yeah, when you rip the neuron, you know, from A to B in your brain, your body is going to grow a new pathway, but it's longer. And so the brain just has to work harder to do the same things. And I should say, I feel like I at this point, I'm long past due saying a caveat that I consider myself so lucky. And I'm so grateful that there are so many with far worse brain injuries than I. I have all my arms and legs, you know, like I think that part of the story is that while I would never want to speak for any other veteran, I'm not unique in this or any worse or, you know, it's not so atypical, right? Like it's not extraordinary except in its ordinariness.
Yeah. So was it the things that you forgot? Because you forgot big chunks of your life before with your wife and your kids.
Yeah, I still don't. I mean, those don't come back.
Well, so that's the question. What was that, a physical part of the brain that was just stripped away, or is there some? Because then you do remember other things. So is this a physical thing, or is this an emotional thing?
I think it's both, but it really is the physical nature of it is why that these things don't come back.
Yeah.
So like I don't remember my kids' first steps, but I do remember looking at photos of my kids' first steps. And I think a lot of us have that with our childhood, right? Like what's your earliest memory? And you remember photos of your childhood, but not necessarily the actual experience. Well, I have that with things like asking my wife to marry me. And this was... It, for a long time, that caused a lot of conflict. Why? Like it was a choice that I would choose to remember one thing and not another. When for me, it still feels really arbitrary. And I mean, there's some military things. Basically, like 99 to about 05, I'd say I have about half.
Wow.
Yeah, half.
There's this really powerful moment in the opera where... You're the person playing you.
Right.
Is talking to Jessie, your wife. And you ask her to fill in the blanks.
Right.
And she's like, I'm not really sure. And it's a really beautiful moment. And you say, just try. And so she talks about the day Martin, your son, turned two. And the fact that Sam loves the state fair. And the fact that Virgil, your son, hates haircuts.
Right.
And the fact that on the day that you did propose, even though you don't remember any of that, she was wearing a red dress.
Right.
How did you react to that scene and that moment where she's relaying, filling in the blanks?
Yeah. So can I tell you something about what a gift this opera has been? So my wife didn't do that. This was something that Jeremy and Howard Beck, the composer, and Stephanie Fleischman, the librettist, made up. They made up that scene. And then after Jessie and I saw the opera, she started doing that.
Wow.
And it's such a tremendous gift that the opera has given our family, because that's what I needed and I didn't know to ask that. But once I saw it acted out for me, we do that. And it has been tremendous for our family and really healing. And instead of Jessie saying, well, why don't you remember this? She just accepts that I don't and then tells me about it. And it's like we share the moment over again.
It's Brian Kastner. His memoir is called The Long Walk. It's the basis for the opera of the same name. And tomorrow and Saturday night, Utah Opera is performing The Long Walk at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. It's under the direction of David Schweitzer with Stephen Osgood conducting. For tickets, you can call 801-355-ARTS or just visit us at radiowest.org for links and more information. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
This is no life.
won't always be here. Crazy we'll go.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Brian Kastner. We're talking about his memoir, The Long Walk, which is also the basis of an opera being performed in Salt Lake City over the weekend. We'll give you more details about that a little bit later on the program. How did you react when somebody suggested to you, hey, we think your book would make a really good opera?
This book was such a roller coaster in that I was not a professional writer beforehand. I didn't know how writing worked. I didn't know how the business worked. I didn't know I needed an agent. And I wrote this book, found an agent right away, found a publisher right away, broke a lot of the standard rules when it comes to that. And so I had all of these new things happening constantly. And the book came out in July of 2012. And then a few months later, my agent called and said, hey, there's this idea. Sit down, don't laugh, and take it seriously.
Right, right.
You know, and at the time, it was just one more new thing that was happening. But Jeremy and Stephanie, they provided this treatment with all of these ideas, and it was clear. I mean, a lot of these ideas have survived into the opera. The fact that the boys would be a boys' choir and sing together sometimes.
Yeah.
But what was beyond the specific details, the point was they took it so seriously and had read every word of that book about six times and deconstructed it. And just the honor of that somebody would spend that much time with your work, right? And then had put in the effort to reimagine it into this other thing. I mean, I was sold immediately. I didn't know that much about opera. I had been to I had seen a couple performances maybe here and there. I had a little bit of a musical background, but not operatic background. The joke is, my wife makes the joke that she pulled out her bucket list and wrote down, have an opera made of my life,
right.
Just so she could then cross it out.
Right.
So because it was just so unlikely, but it has turned into this amazing thing for our family. The way I look at it now, my children have an opera of their childhood. What an amazing gift that I couldn't give them on my own, of course. It was a hard childhood. It's not all happy, but it's honest and it's real, and they did a great job.
There's a moment in the opera, speaking of that, where you're away, you're gone, and Jesse and the kids are just tearing around the house in this kind of utter moment of joy. The kids are just laughing and ripping around. And I can't remember who it is. I think it's Virgil who says, I wish Daddy wasn't coming home.
Right.
How did you react when you first saw that?
Yeah, they didn't make that up. I mean, that's true. And I had always tried to focus the book on getting the feeling right, even if they were difficult or hard things to face. And so, I mean, it's not like it was the first time I had heard that. And that's true to life. And I don't think that scene is actually in the book itself, of course. It's that Stephanie, came and spent a couple days with us in Buffalo and spent time talking to Jesse. And yeah, when I used to be a consultant, after I got out of the military, I trained other bomb technicians before they deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan. And so there was a couple years there during the surges where I think I trained every single Army EOD soldier before they deployed, a couple thousand. And so I was gone constantly. And when I was gone, the house was happy and loud and screaming. And when I walked in, every door and window shut and it was quiet until I left again. And I mean, I lived through it. I didn't need Jeremy and Stephanie to tell me that happened.
There's a moment in the book where you tell the story of encountering this. This is, again, in an aftermath of an explosion, and you encounter this small group of women across the street from, there's a bomb crater. And they start to scream because some of the children have been killed in this explosion.
Right.
I'm trying to imagine the screaming. I'm imagining it as screaming and wailing Can you describe it?
It is so irritating. And that, I know that sounds like a really insensitive word, but it is shrieks on the edge of hearing, and it is all the human anguish you could possibly imagine. And I don't have flashbacks like you think about from the movies or something. Like I don't have flashbacks, but the closest I ever got to a flashback was in the libretto reading of this opera, the very first time I heard it read back. And the two actresses that were screaming in Arabic, like, I put my head between my hands and then, like, ran out and smoked about half a pack of cigarettes. And I quit smoking years ago. It's blood-curdling. And it's all of – it's you know, a lot of Arab societies live very publicly on the street. It's not in a lot of American culture, you grieve in your home away from everybody. But in that culture, it's all very public. And so it was completely appropriate to what you know, was happening in front of them.
There's this other thing that's going on, though, in this moment. And there's this teenage boy who, as you describe it in the book, whose direct gaze burned through the armored glass between us, and he wouldn't stop looking at you.
Right.
And then you have this kind of migraine, and this sound is happening, and you say in the book, I could do it. I could kill these women to stop all of this.
Right.
What's happening?
I'm imagining if, like, any of the listeners have ever been in pain, or somebody is doing something to you and, like, you are desperate to stop it. And I think that if that's a feeling we've all had, now imagine if you have a rifle and you're in the middle of a war and you realize that you really do have the means to stop it. And when I grew up Catholic, and I learned that I had this thing called a conscience, and my conscience would keep me from doing bad things. But I think I also learned as a kid that, like, the conscience applied to things like stealing candy from a store, like all these, like, really basic small things. And the idea that you would murder someone in, you know, deliberately, dispassionately, you know, that was that's not something your conscience applied to, because it was so far beyond the pale of right. human behavior. Right. And so I guess I always assumed that I had some gag reflex that would stop me from being able to do these things. And I realized then that it was a conscious choice and that I was as capable of doing that as anyone else. And so I guess I learned something about myself that, yes, I am capable of doing this thing. And what kind of person am I now that I am capable of doing this thing? When it feels like a choice as simple as, like, putting on my coat before I walk out of here.
One of the things the opera does is put down to music this sentiment that was expressed by Jesse's grandmother. And what she tells her in this aria in the opera is that you will not come home, that the war will kill you, that in essence, you're as good as dead.
Right.
And that it would be better, in fact, that you die over there because, as the aria puts it, the war will kill him at home. How do you think about that, and how you and where you are now? And was she right in some ways? Did something in you die back, you know, over there?
Oh yeah, I understand what she means. And of course, this was, this woman had a very depression era upbringing, yeah. that was really instructing to her, and had a husband that went to, well, she buried two husbands, one that went to World War II and came back different and died of a heart attack.
Died pretty young.
Died very young, yeah. At a heart attack at about the age that I am now, actually. And so her experience says that, yes, that he's going to be a different person when he comes home, and it will kill him eventually, you know, literally and figuratively. And it's the figuratively part that I guess I really do agree with. I think that part of the challenge of veterans coming home, just generally, is that we as a culture expect them to somehow be the same person when they come back. And of course, how could he or she be after that experience? And I've done some research and reading, you know, there's a certain Native American tribe, and I apologize, can never remember the name. But before they would send their warriors into battle, they would hold a funeral. Because no matter what happened in that battle, either they lived through it or they died, nobody was coming back the way they were. And the tribe, the culture recognized that. It's a little bit like that the Irish would hold funerals in Ireland before they would send family members to America. Yes, they could send letters back and forth, but they were fundamentally – either they would never see them again or they were fundamentally different people. And I think that's really the key truth. And in that way, her grandmother is right. I mean, I am different.
I want to ask you to read something, if you wouldn't mind, here finally.
Sure.
The question was, did you have PTSD? And you're in therapy, you're having this conversation, and your therapist has this kind of insight, and I find it remarkable. And it seems really powerful. It comes right at the end of the book. Do you want to say something about it? Do you want to read this first?
I guess I'll say that, yeah, I do think that it's important, and that's why it's at the end of the book as well. I think the important thing is PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, is a very popular phrase right now, and there's been a lot of awareness campaigns about it, and that is really important. But it is still like a single diagnosis. It's not. It's only one thing, and it's a brush that's pretty broad right now when we paint, and there's more to it, and I guess that's what this is about. "You don't have PTSD," my new shrink says. "What are you talking about?" I'm incredulous. She turns at her desk and reaches for a fat book on a nearby shelf. My stomach drops, fills with a nervous hole that briefly overwhelms the crazy. My new shrink flips through her clinical handbook, searching for the correct page. "You don't have nightmares," she starts, scrolling down the list. "No, I dream during the day." "You don't have one incident, one trauma that you constantly obsess over or replay in your mind," she says. "No, there are many." "You haven't blocked out memories of any trauma," she says. "No, the war is vivid. It's the other things that I've forgotten." "You don't startle at loud noises or get nervous in public or avoid places that remind you of what's happened." "Of course not. That passed long ago, and my rifle is ready when I need it." "You got out of bed this morning. You haven't retreated into a shell and turned off your interaction with the world," she concludes. "Don't be scared of the soft sand," I think. "But what about the hopelessness and the numbness," I say? "What about the airport and the chest pain and the eye twitches? What about the hairy spider that crawled out of my head? What about the bodies and the smells? What about knowing I won't live past today? What about the things I was willing to do? What about my lost faith and innocence? What about the crazy feeling?" I ask. "This all can't be for nothing." "Just because you feel all those things doesn't mean you have PTSD," she chides gently. "So if I'm not crazy, then what's wrong with me?" She laughs, a silver waterfall of ringing bells. "You're human," she says.
Brian Kastner. His memoir, The Long Walk, is the basis for the opera of the same name. On Friday and Saturday night at 7:30, the Utah Opera will perform The Long Walk at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. It's under the direction of David Schweitzer and Stephen Osgood conducting. For tickets, you can call 801-355-ARTS or just go to radiowest.org for the particulars. We'll send you the links there. Brian Kastner, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
He's coming home, and when he does, your story, it's not coming true. Not on my watch, not on this man.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Brian Kastner's story as the leader of a bomb disposal team in Iraq. The book he wrote is brutal and honest. It's also the basis of an opera being performed in Salt Lake City this weekend. Joining us on the program is Stephanie Fleischman, a playwright and librettist whose work has been performed across the United States. She wrote the libretto for The Long Walk. And Jeremy Howard Beck is with us, a composer whose operas have been performed around the country. He created the music for The Long Walk. I wanted to begin how you found the story. Now, as I understand it, you'd gotten a commission. You were both looking for ideas. Jeremy wanders into a bookstore and happens upon Brian's book? Is that how it worked?
Yeah, well, the reason I wandered into that bookstore, I did it in kind of a fit of despair because we had spent about a month and a half pitching ideas past each other. And Stephanie pitched something to me. I said no. I pitched something to her. She said no. Larry Edelson at American Lyric Theater, the commissioner, pitched ideas to both of us. We both said no. So I just went to the Annapolis Barnes & Noble, which is enormous, and started photographing dust jackets. And there was Brian's book freshly out, like dead center on the new releases table right as I walked in. And then Stephanie read it and immediately called me and told me that I had to read it.
He sent you a lot of dust jacket. Yeah. What was it about that one?
Well, I had written a music theater piece that was much farther away from reality, but it was about war. It was about a secret war and the fallout from that war, and it was completely imaginary. And I'd had some powerful experiences with panels, with veterans talking about their experience. And so I was interested in exploring war from a different perspective. Yeah. And getting into the sort of more gritty, visceral, real world of war. So I was just curious.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting, and I wonder if maybe this was something that you noticed right away, because you've talked about how musical his prose is.
Mm-hmm.
And that is one thing that's fairly distinctive about the way he writes.
Yes.
In fact, I was going through the book noticing these moments where they were almost like poetry, where these refrains would keep coming over and over again. Did you notice that right away?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Both the voice, Brian's voice, that it's a kind of like in your ear, very, you feel like you're listening to a friend.
Yeah.
And the poetry combined just really brought both of us into the world of the book. But for me also, the refrains are images. They're really powerful images. And that's really important to me as a writer, is to have those powerful visual images.
Speaking of images, this is something that came up in our conversation with Brian, was the really graphic nature of some of the imagery. What did you make of that, and what you thought you could do with that, or how that might work in a piece of opera?
Well, some of it became lyrics. Some of the language actually became part of the libretto, but some of it actually became scenes. The scene where Brian finds the foot in the box became a scene. Yeah. The scene with the screaming women became a scene. And those were really challenging scenes to write because I had to live with them for a really long time. And I started asking actor friends of mine, how do you not take difficult material home with you when work is hard? And they all said, well, it's kind of unavoidable.
It's one of the casualties of making art.
Yeah. You know, like, you make yourself a good meal and you get a good night's sleep and, you know, maybe you take a bath and you take
and then you start again next.
And then you
tomorrow.
Go back to work the next day.
Yeah.
But like the screaming women scene in particular, the challenge was to make it so that Brian's realization that he could shoot them would be the same realization that the audience was having at the same time. So that they would identify with that, and so that, you know, to be perfectly frank about it, that by the end of the scene, when he wants to shoot them, that they would also want him to shoot them. And to do that, I had to come up with some really gnarly sounds and build the tension in that scene for a really long time. And it was very complicated to write, and it took a very long time. And that kind of thing happened again and again.
Did you feel like you were losing your mind at moments?
Yes.
Yeah.
Because it was just in my head all the time.
Yeah.
And I found myself maybe identifying with it a little too closely.
Wow.
I think maybe the experience of the opera is better for it, but at times it was quite difficult to go to work every day knowing that I had to like face those women.
Wow. Stephanie, what about you? So it's one thing to confront this story with music. Now you have to deal with words. I mean, what was that like for you?
Well, I think that in a way, words are one step removed from music is more right in there.
That's so interesting.
And I had to craft words that supported music. And also, like the opening of the opera, the prologue, when he's running and he's receiving all these images in fragments from his experience in Iraq, a lot of those images are not in the words. They're only in the music. And we made space in the libretto. We wrote in parentheses these images.
Wreckage, so, havoc, yeah. Sewage.
Yeah. But they're not actually spoken out loud at that point in the opera.
Yeah. This comes later. We'll actually, I want to hear a few moments. But so what we're hearing is him singing The Lawns Are Green, the street, because he's now in a suburban environment going on a run. So we're hearing him say, the lawns are green, the streets are wide, ranch houses gleam, regular suburb, but the subtext is swamps and blood and trash and motor oil.
And the running is the effort to keep those images at bay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, and so there was this idea of worlds colliding. And colliding is sometimes what happens, but sometimes it's more like an overlay in like in an anatomy textbook. We're like, here are the bones, here are the muscles, here are the nerves. And so when Brian is running in the prologue, the text is just a description of what's around him.
Yeah.
And the crazy, which really lives in the orchestra... The orchestra is kind of a character, is giving you all of this other information, and you're not quite sure at that point what it is. But that music comes back later with words.
I want to ask about, and maybe this is the scene, this is the final scene from Act One, where, and there's a chorus of men here. And in this, we'll hear baritone Daniel Belcher, he created the role. He's performing it here in Salt Lake. Is this the moment that you're talking about? Set this up for us, I guess.
Yeah, okay. So Brian runs several times in the opera.
Yeah.
And this is at the end of Act One, he has, you know, tried and failed to function at one of his kids' birthday parties. He has sort of gotten to the end of his rope in a way. And so he runs, which is what he always does, and which usually works. In the prologue, he's able to sort of push it down and keep it at bay. And this time it's much more intense and he's, you know, more stressed out and less able to control it. And so it's all just closer.
Yeah.
And the music that did not have words before now does.
Yeah. I sort of picture it as in the opening he's running away from those memories and at this moment he's running towards them.
Yeah.
And they're consuming him.
Well, here's a moment from the opera, The Long Walk. You did interviews, and I wanted to ask you about that. Why wasn't the book enough? Why did you need to go and talk to Brian and his wife, Jessie?
Well, I felt like the arc of his book was ultimately about how he made it through in order to be there and be a part of that family. And Brian made a very conscious choice to keep his family at the edges of the book because he didn't want to speak for them.
Right.
And especially for his young boys, he wanted to protect them. And because these were bodies on stage and this was a family and really the great drama is made up of the family unit, it felt really important to understand more about what was missing in the book or what he had chosen to leave out. And so that was a really fruitful exercise, going there to meet them and spend time with them and talk to Jesse as well.
It's almost as if the opera is as much about her as it is Brian.
Yeah, I don't know if that was what we set out to do, but I think the dichotomy, the conflict between the two of them and is at the heart of the opera. Yeah.
There's Jeremy, one of the things you've talked about is there's this disconnect between veterans and civilians, that they're isolated because their experience, like, you can't have an experience like that unless you've been there. And so how did you reflect that sense of isolation in the opera?
Well, just on a purely practical level, the opera takes place in their house. And there are a couple of scenes outside the house, but it really is just a domestic family drama.
Can I ask you about this, though? Because I did wonder about this. So the setting is the house. But I also wondered, you know, like Death of a Salesman actually plays out in Willie's head. And I wondered in some ways if, okay, so the setting's the house, but it's really Brian's brain. Mm-hmm. Did you ever think about it in that sense? Because it kind of occurred to me.
Yeah, it's, you know, what is that thing, like, you know, the time is now, the place is ancient Greece. It's that kind of a thing where it is in the house, but it's also kind of not in the house.
Of course.
And the house on stage is a kind of fractured house.
Yeah.
It's not – it's straightforward house.
It's pretty stylized.
Yeah.
But that was that perception among people that unless you've been there, you can't possibly get it, was a thing that I had to – get past in order to write it, because I am not a veteran. I don't come from a military family. The wars that have been taking place for my entire adult life have been sort of background, the way that I'm looking out at the mountains now. They were these distant kind of things. Mm. And I had to get past that because, you know, who am I to write this? And I realized that I really don't agree with that. Hmm. I think that people mean well when they say it, so I totally understand what they mean. But I think that that attitude actually contributes to the isolation and heightens it, because it builds the wall between civilians and the military just a little bit higher.
Yeah.
And so my goal with the opera was to...
Well, he says, Brian says in the play, sorry to cut you off, but he says at that last scene in the book, she says, you're human.
Yeah, exactly. And so is it pleasant to empathize with these experiences? No, but is it necessary? Absolutely. Yeah. And it's possible. You know, with the scene that we created from the idea of the foot in the box, that was perhaps the most difficult one to get into, because it required me to really identify with an idea of, like, not just the sort of intellectual idea that everyone dies someday, you will die someday, but that you are going to die right now. Mm. And to really just live with that at work, you know, hours a day, every day, for weeks, months. And I found that it was actually really easy to do. What was difficult was when I finished that scene on Veterans Day, as it would happen.
Really?
Yeah, and I had to have, like, Brian talk me down, because it was just kind of upsetting in a way that I couldn't quite explain. But after I finished the scene, I couldn't – I had opened that box and couldn't quite close it again for weeks afterwards. And I was really surprised by how much it affected me.
The New York Times mentioned that there's this scene really early on. It's the scene that I was talking to Brian about Jesse going to talk to her grandmother.
Yeah.
She tells him he's not going to come home. He's as good as dead, basically. And the New York Times mentioned that this would fit pretty neatly into Greek tragedy.
Sure.
You know, prophecies from, you know, from an oracle, from a wise old woman.
Yeah, and in my plans and our outlines, I referred to it as the prophecy.
So that's it, right?
Yeah.
And then the fact that there's a chorus, it has a very much a Greek tragedy feel, a kind of really classic sense to it. Is that right?
Yeah, and maybe I didn't like consciously think to do that. I used the word prophecy because I thought that's what it is. But one of the ways that I composed the score was for things to have motivic roles where they return. And so the idea of he won't come home, how will we deal with it when he does, floats from character to character and situation to situation. And one of the main sort of dramatic arcs of the opera is the arc of that prophecy and how Jesse relates to it, how Brian relates to it, and how it affects not just Brian, but each of the other men in his unit.
And the children.
Right.
How do people react? What are the audiences like? What do they say when they see this opera?
Well, in Saratoga, it felt really like a profound communal experience that people were deeply, deeply moved, and that the audience and the performers were all going through an experience together and kind of coming out the other side together. So by the middle of the second act, there's just so much feeling in the house. It's very intense, in a good way.
Yeah. Stephanie Fleischman, she wrote the libretto for the opera The Long Walk. Jeremy Howard Beck is the composer. We talked to Brian Kastner earlier. Friday and Saturday night at 7:30, Utah Opera is performing The Long Walk, the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. There are cast details, links to learn more about the opera, and, of course, ticket information on our website, radiowest.org. Stephanie, Jeremy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.